Welcome everybody to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thanks for joining us here on the live call or on the podcast for Productivity Book Group. Today on this call, we'll be discussing Monday Morning Choices, 12 Powerful Ways to Go from Everyday to Extraordinary. The book is by David Cottrell, and he's the author of several books. We're going to be covering chapters 1 through 6 today. And as always, I just wanted to hear everyone's sort of initial, sort of general reaction to this reading selection, the first 6 chapters. What did you think about the writing quality, style, organization of the material, the first 6 values that he sort of makes, value statements he makes in terms of having to make those Monday morning choices? What are your initial responses to the book so far?
This is Miranda. I'll start. I like the book. I thought it was organized well. A tad preachy, but very good content.
Good, good. And welcome, Miranda. Margaret?
Yeah, it read a little bit like a sort of like a motivational pep rally, and I can see why doing it a week at a time would be a lot better than trying to read several chapters in a row. So when I went back through my notes and the things I'd highlighted, there really were some nuggets in here for me. But when it's anecdotal, is not really my preferred style. So I'm more on the brain science and the research, more where you land, Ray. And I'm used to more background, I think. And so I had to sort of get over the anecdotal style. But when I went back through it this morning to refresh myself on it, it's like, I did like it. I did like it.
That's always good. Yeah, and I agree. There's a sense of, as Miranda said, it's a little preachy at times, and I think it's also important to understand that the book itself has value in even different, I try to look at books as having different value even when I sometimes am not really cued into it, because it doesn't have all of the research and science sort of behind it that's written into the book, and that's not the case here, but it's still a good read,
Right, and it's Margaret again. I could see how actually doing it week by week, where you're focusing on one chapter and kind of digesting it week by week and putting it into practice, would be a much different and richer experience, I believe, than just reading it and thinking about it without actually having the ongoing weekly discussion the way he sets it up.
Right. I was actually really curious about whether anybody wanted to or had, gone through the process of finding an accountability person, an accountability partner, to go through the process of actually making, making it a week by week kind of discovery of these Monday morning choices. That includes anybody listening to the podcast. Go ahead, Miranda.
This is Miranda, and no, I haven't.
Yeah, I think it'll be really good if there are people out there who need that level of accountability to sort of have those discussions. And as I said before we started the call, I found that the Monday morning discussion questions that he has in the book are really useful. So I thought it would be really fun to actually discuss the discussion questions as the book posits them, because I think it would be really good not only for our own discussion, but also if you then do decide to have those conversations with an accountability partner and sort of follow it on that week-by-week basis like Margaret talks about, then you sort of have a chance to have some priming as it relates to the questions as well as what your thoughts are on them. And so I want to get right into the first chapter here, where he talks about sort of this idea of choosing not to be a victim. And his first discussion question, I'm going to read all three and we can just sort of discuss them as sort of a grouping. But he says, why is it so easy to fall into the victim mentality? When have we been victimized in the past, and how did we respond? And is it really possible to accept total responsibility for things that happen to us? Does the buck really stop with us? So this really brings into, the idea of not only not victim thinking or victim thinking when you are doing it, but also sort of, taking personal responsibility or accountability. And what immediately comes to mind is The Question Behind the Question by John G. Miller. And for those who haven't heard me talk about the book before or heard any podcasts where I've talked about it, it's a fantastic book. It's a short read and a fantastic perspective on taking personal accountability seriously. So I was curious what folks had to think about those sort of discussion questions. Why is it so easy to fall victim, a victim-to-victim mentality, that is?
I think some of it is like some of the examples in the chapter where society seems to be rewarding some of the victimization, it's not their fault because X, Y, and Z. And often things are not people's fault, as he also talks about, but there still is a choice to how we respond to things. And I think that that's the struggle. It feels like we're trying to swim upstream to take self-responsibility to, you know, be accountable for our choices and to keep making that decision to keep growing. I mean, he keeps talking about, throughout all of it, being active and doing and moving towards the things that we've set up. And that's really countercultural in a lot of ways, in a lot of segments. Which
I think
kind of jumping into one of his other things, too, of it's so important to find people that approach things like that the same way that you do or that have a similar commitment to it so that then you can be encouraged and be in a place and a group that encourages self-accountability, self-responsibility, and direction rather than sort of drifting. Because I think it's easy to drift, and then it's easy to feel like life happens to you rather than you're an active agent in your own life.
Absolutely, absolutely. Miranda?
Well, I have a couple of things. I've struggled with this idea for a long time. And, you know, the first thing that you know, you hear little people say when something happens that they don't think should happen is, that's not fair. And so we all have an idea, I think, of how we think things should be. And I think it's getting past the sense of injustice when something happens that's beyond your control that you didn't deserve, and you're like, wait a minute here. So, you know, I was discussing this, I think about 10 years ago with someone and talking about accountability. And, you know, I'm like, there are some things that happen. I don't have to make amends for some things. I don't have to do that because I don't feel that what happened was justified, and I didn't deserve it, and I didn't call, you know, I didn't have a role in bringing it about. And so the person said to me, well, that's fine. You don't have to be accountable for those things that you didn't, you know, call into your life, but you do have to make amends to yourself for how to keep yourself stuck there. And so, you know, it's looking at things that way. So you're making your personal accountability may not be for the event, but it's in how you are not moving past it or how you perpetuate it.
Right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting to me, I always look at this from the perspective, you know, as someone who, you know, my undergraduate work was in clinical psychology and therapeutic counseling, and I always look at the perspective on how people don't give themselves the responsibility to feel what they are allowed to feel, you know, and that includes feeling bad about a situation without necessarily feeling victim to someone else and to those kinds of things. I always tell people you are allowed to feel whatever you want. You're not allowed to do what you want. So feeling and action are these two sides of the coin there that you really need to give yourself permission to feel, but you also need to understand that there's forward movement no matter what, and you can make good choices about how to respond to your situation, circumstance, external stimuli, people, that kind of thing. Or you can choose to just, you know, just keep absorbing this emotional, you know, feeling and not doing anything. I mean, not doing anything is, of course, always the worst case scenario, which is being frozen in the state. So I always think a victim mentality for me especially is one in which I don't react, you know, not reacting in a healthy response. That is, when someone is acting in a healthy manner and your best response is no response, but literally freezing, you know, in the moment and not actually acting appropriately to take care of the situation for yourself. You know, it's like, oh, so-and-so did such-and-such to me. I'll give the anecdote that I had an employer that wasn't so great. And in that circumstance, you know, I think everyone in the firm at the time felt victimized. And, you know, it was one of those cases where I was young at the time and a boisterous kind of sort, and was willing to speak up on the and was willing to speak up on behalf of not only myself but also the staff. And that created clearly a large conflict within the organization, because I was willing to not be a victim and also not to be a part of the organizational culture's victimization. You know, it was like everybody together felt like a victim. And I was like, this is insane. Why are we all doing this to ourselves? And, you know, and so I think that it's really important for us all to remember that productivity equates to not just you doing that for yourself individually, but sometimes you can be the impetus. You know, you don't have to be a hero, but you can certainly be the impetus for the change in victim mentality on an organizational cultural level. Any other thoughts about victim mentality and sort of overcoming victimization and that kind of thing before we move on to the next chapter?
This is Miranda again.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
I was thinking that it might be attractive to be a victim because at least if you're a victim, you are on the side of right and righteousness, right? I mean, because the other thing that happened to you or the person that did it is bad, and so that means you're good. So, you know, so it gives you a bit of a, I don't know, a one-up in terms of, your, I don't want to say perception because I don't think that's the right word. Am I making sense?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. It's becoming self-righteous on some level is a kind of victimization. You know, I actually fielded an email yesterday where a person was telling me that they left a career path because no one else around them had the same high enough morals, high enough values to getting there, you know, and there's a healthy line, you know, that is, I chose to cut my losses and move on, but then there's sort of a secondary stage, which is, woe is me, you know, feel some level of pity for me because I couldn't make it past all of the injustice that was compounded on my shoulders, you know, and so I can see that. I can definitely see that.
And if we're, to build on that, if we are convinced we're right, then we don't feel the need to change necessarily. And that's one of the things I've been kind of dealing with. I left a fairly intense job a couple of months ago, and there were things where I knew I was right, but that didn't really make any difference in that circumstance. And it took a long time and a lot of work to get past, well, because I was right, they should have X, Y, or Z. And it's like, no, you know what? I didn't read the situation well enough. And I think I still think I wouldn't be there. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of opportunity for success in that particular environment. But I think if I had read the situation more clearly at the beginning and worked more to figure out what they actually wanted instead of what they said they wanted, then me doing, quote, the right thing would not have been so costly to me. I don't know if that makes sense, but because I knew what needed to be done, part of the cost I paid was because it wasn't actually what they wanted done. And I, by the time I realized that, I was kind of deeply entrenched in, but this is what needs to be done. And as I've gotten distance and perspective on it, and also somebody recommended a book called, I don't remember what it was called, but it talked about, you know, you can be right, but that can still be the wrong thing to do. Of kind of letting go of that being right and stepping back and going for how can we, you know, come to some level of agreement instead of just solidifying, like what Miranda was saying, of that kind of the moral high ground of, well, I'm right, so therefore you are wrong. And people
right.
on the other side of a conflict don't really want to hear that. And so So it's a really interesting learning experience that I can be completely right and still completely not do. I think I'll just sum it up as it was a really good learning experience because, again, I'm not sure that doing things differently because I've seen people in that particular instance approach things in very different ways, and it is really almost impossible to succeed there. So I'm not saying if I had changed it, I would have succeeded more in that particular place. But by not changing, I acutely learned the necessity for other situations to be a little, to have a broader field of perspective, I think, going into a new situation.
Right, and that's really...
To not get rigidly stuck.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's really important for people to take to heart, which is, you know, not persisting yourself into a corner, you know, with the feelings of being the victim and or being right. And, you know, whenever I think of people who are being too self-righteous or just righteous in some capacity and then it becomes sort of twisted, is that they then they attempt to compromise their own morals or their own values for the sake of making progress, you know, in a situation that, like yourself, you know, you couldn't, and even if you had compromised your morals or your values in that state of being, you wouldn't have actually made progress.
It wouldn't have actually helped.
Right. So it's like, no, you just have to cut your losses and walk away sometimes from
absolutely.
Situations like that.
And with great pleasure.
Well, good, good. So I want to segue us into chapter 2, where David Cottrell talks about the commitment choice. And this is where he talks about, you know, staying the course and surrounding yourself with people who are committed. He uses the word passionate, and, you know, in sort of this, I need someone my equal in passion and commitment to my, into their own goals and to your goals respectively, and clarifying your commitment. So putting your goals into words and into writing so that you know what you're going to accomplish in the next X period of time. So his questions, his Monday morning discussion questions are, do you have to be passionate about something to be committed? I think all of us could probably agree on the one word answer to that. Two is to, can you be committed to both work and family at the same time? And three, name a person who's an inspiration to you. Describe the traits of that person. Are passionate and committed to traits of two of the traits you described. So let's start off with number one and two. Do you have to be passionate about something to be committed? And two, can you be committed to both work and family at the same time?
So I actually see the first one as shades of gray. Certainly, if you're going to be committed to something and function at or near your best, then being passionate about it is going to have all kinds of ramifications for how easy it is to do things and the degree of engagement that you feel, because you're ending up with intrinsic reward from doing something you're passionate about. That said, there are lots of situations where adult responsibilities force us into positions where there are things that have to be done and they require really committing to getting them done, but they aren't necessarily fun or something that you're passionate about. It's just stuff. And those you just go through and you deal with them and do the best you can, and then one hopes at least go back to doing things that you're passionate about.
That's certainly a great perspective, Lee. I think we should all take that to heart. You know, the reality is that sometimes the mundane aspects of life are there, and we do have to do them.
But definitely you want to be on the yes side.
So it's like working toward that side of the spectrum.
Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's the being tied into the bigger goal. Like, I've got the cat walking back and forth and trying to help me here while I'm on phone call. And the thing that came to mind was, I'm really not passionate about doing the litter box, you know, but I am committed to doing the litter box because, you know, the bigger commitment to the cat, whereas that's a piece of it. Or like when people are, you know, like working towards a degree or something and there's coursework that doesn't exactly ignite their passions. I can think of a number of classes that I took that were required when I was going to college, but not things that I necessarily would have chosen on my own to study. But because of my bigger commitment to the degree, I was willing to, you know, dig in and do the work in the class I didn't particularly care for, because it got me where I wanted to go, even if that particular step I couldn't be that passionate about. And in some cases, I found someone who was passionate about the topic and got them to kind of drag me through it.
Yeah, and it's always important to sort of think about the horizons of going up a horizon in terms of your perspective to find greater motivation. You know, I when people frequently tell me that they'd like to lose weight or that they'd like to get more fit or they'd like to eat better, those kinds of situations, you know, it's usually a superficial one. I want to look better. You know, I want to be able to be more appealing in some way, shape, or form physically. And, you know, for me, it's always been the desire to be able to play kickball or baseball or whatever it might be, football with my grandkids. You know, it's the idea that I want to be healthy enough that I make it to that point in a way that makes me functional for them. I don't really care what I look like. Not that I don't care what I look like, but you know what I mean? That's so limited in my own world that the reason I'm committed to my fitness routine and eating well like I do, you know, my nutrition and fitness and sleep and those kinds of things sleep to a lesser extent, but I'm working on it. is really so that I can be there to see, if not my own grandchildren, certainly, you know, there are six of us in my family, so there's six siblings, and, you know, I want to make sure that I see my nieces and nephews grow up and for them to have kids and to, you know, see all that kind of stuff happen. So it's really important to me to see the family legacy go on and to experience it with them. So when I'm not passionate about the thing that I might have to do in terms of the next action, which is, you know, make that next phone call or get up and put my running shoes on and head out the door on a rainy day, certainly I'm passionate about the end goal. So I try and go up that level and say, you know what, this is going to be worth it in 40 years because I'm still going to be here. I'm going to still be, you know, having an exciting life and enjoying that time with X people that I love in my life. So then on to the second question here, which is, can you be committed to both work and family at the same time?
Yes, and I think the choice needs to be made how are you going to resolve conflicts when they're pulling in two different directions? And he gave the example of, I think it was in this chapter, of being offered a promotion that would involve disrupting his whole family, and his family was like, you're the only one that thinks this is a good idea. Right. Or maybe it was in the values and choosing your enemies, but the idea of balancing isn't the right word. But, I mean, there are times where you can be passionate about your work and committed to your work, and if something happens in the family, if someone is sick or hospitalized or, you know, whatever, where the work stuff gets handled, delegated, set aside, and you deal with the family stuff, or sometimes not. I mean, depending on each individual person or what their ranking of those priorities are. So I don't think it can be an equal commitment to both, because then if when there is a conflict, I mean, work tends to be, work isn't very, often can be not considerate of family commitments. Let's put it that way. And is that a really strong determination that family is going to get time and attention, and this is speaking from experience in various times in my life, it has been easy for work to kind of overtake other areas of life. And so trying to, as I'm, you know, in this transition and I've started working with a new company this week, of how do I maintain a little bit better, in my case, I think a better time balance than perhaps recently. But so yes and, yes and no. You can't be equally committed to both at the same exact moment. I mean, I think there's a flow back and forth with one or the other needing to be the one that gets the deal breaker, and different people make different choices on how that is.
Yeah, I think I slice it sort of, I probably slice it differently with the same outcome, which is that I tend to think of it in sort of a weighted scale. And maybe it's just because I used to get good grades in school, and so I like grades. But it's more or less the idea that, you know, if you think of it in a weighted scale perspective, I may spend 80% of my time working, but that doesn't mean that work takes up 80% of my care. So, you know, like, I care about my family and I spend as much time as I can to make it useful to everyone in my family's life. You know, today's a case in point where, you know, I've made a sacrifice to, you know, do something for my family that I otherwise would have probably been working. And so it's just one of those things where it's like, you know where to place energy so that it makes the most impact. And that's sort of how I've done it, you know, just from a productivity perspective. What I've done recently is I've made a list of all the important people in my life, both family and personal, and I've just created a call list. And so instead of, you know, it being like a next action list or anything else like that, it's when I have 5 minutes to call so-and-so, I'm going to pick the next person on the list who I haven't called in a while, and I'm going to call them, whether that's a brother, sister, cousin, aunt, uncle, you know, grandparents, that kind of thing. I'm just going to make that phone call and say, I have 5 minutes. I just want to call and tell you that I loved you. And, you know, these are the things going on in my life. What's going on in yours? And if I have 10 minutes, then I have 10 minutes. If I have 5 minutes, I have 5 minutes. But I tell them right up front, you know, so that they know and they're not shocked by it. But they also are happy to hear my voice. I'm happy to hear theirs. You know, it's just sort of a nice way to just capture that, even though I don't particularly consider them a second in tier of commitment, it's just a different balance.
Yeah.
And then David's final question was to name a person who is an inspiration to you, describing the traits of that person, and are they passionate and committed? Are passionate and committed two of the traits you described? Who'd like to offer up a person who's an inspiration to them? If I had to pick someone, I would probably pick David Allen, but you probably would have already known that, and of course I would have to say both passion and commitment are two core pieces of his world. I think, you know, he always jokingly says he's the laziest person on the planet, which is why he does everything so efficiently. But I believe at the core of that is passion. He's passionate about doing the things that really make him happy and are fruitful to his world and environment. And I think that's really powerful. And of course, he's committed to making sure that he has a system that works so that he can make that happen. And so, yes, I would definitely add those two traits among many other accolades. But those are two definite traits that are part of him that definitely inspire me. So if no other thoughts on someone who's inspirational to them, we'll move on to chapter 3, I believe, which is the chapter about choosing your enemies, and this is sort of the values choice. And so he, just as a quick summary, he talks about the book in the sense that he says, surround yourself with people who have similar values and maintain their, maintain an allegiance with you, I believe, through those core values. And he says, take time to identify those who have chosen to be your enemies because they don't have the same values that you do, and understand that you can't please everybody all the time, and that to accept differences, in values will automatically make some people your friends and others your enemies. And so his questions are, why does success create enemies? And then he goes on to ask, describe what values you have that are non-negotiable at work and at home, and is it possible for enemies to make us stronger and better? And so starting off at the top in terms of sort of these values choices, I had a tough time with this chapter in general because I really do believe in surrounding myself with people of different perspectives, not necessarily different values, but sometimes that drills down to someone's core values being very different than mine. And so I'll stop at the fact that the chapter made me very uncomfortable, and in a good way, because it helped me reinforce my own values in terms of wanting people around me who may not agree with me, but I think are strong and core to their own values, and I think that's what's more important to me than necessarily agreeing with my own. And I think that served me well. May not serve everyone well, but I think that in and of itself has served me well. But going on, does anyone believe that success creates enemies?
This is Miranda, and I think it does. And I heard Susie Orman speak about, she wasn't necessarily talking about enemies, but she was talking about a perception of lack. She says that there's, you know, people that feel that, you know, I don't have, or, you know, I don't own, or I don't have, and I have lack in my life, and I can get, but I don't feel as if I actually have unless I have and you don't. So if you have that sense about you, then there can only be one winner, and everybody else has to be a loser for you to be the winner. So that that perspective is the thing that creates the enemy, because that then makes them your competition. So it's not, you know, and then there's the other way of looking at it, where we can all succeed together and we all win. I think that if there's a perception of there's only so much to go around and I have to get my piece, and in order for me to get my piece, you can't have your piece, then you will definitely have a situation in which you will have enemies, because you can only have one winner. That's kind of how she sort of, I'm paraphrasing, but that's how she put it, to, you know, how she phrased it, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's very much a Stephen Covey-based concept, you know, that you either have all winners or the other combinations equate to a loss, because one person loses and one person wins, whether that's in a have or have not scenario or any other real situation in life. I think it's really important for us to have an abundance perspective as it relates to things and to bring everybody up together as opposed to only the few, you know, and I think that that's much more egalitarian. And so if you don't have that perspective, yes, then I certainly believe that that success does and will create enemies. I think also, you know, you don't control everyone, you know, and I think that was sort of stated in the book. And, you know, that from my perspective, if I do something in some environments, politics by itself, you know, internal office politics or organizational politics takes over, and somebody will be, you know, miffed by the way in which you operate, you know. So it doesn't necessarily have to be because you have something or that you are of a certain persuasion about something, but more or less because you did something that they don't agree with. And so, you know, they just feel like, oh, he did that, whether or not it's successful or not. In this particular case, let's say it was a successful project outcome, they're just upset with you because of the way in which you may have approached it, you know, or whatever it might be. So,
Ray, I have something to add to that. I was in a job once where I approached it with my particular mindset, and I was not appreciated for attacking the problem and working on it. I can be kind of relentless when it comes to figuring out a problem and then trying to work to a solution for it. And so the people that were surrounding me and as members of my team didn't appreciate. They had really kind of it was a toxic corporate environment, and so, you know, people that you didn't want to shine, you didn't want to, you know, be noticed, because then it drew criticism. So it was kind of like that. I had a manager that would walk through and she would say, you know, no questions today, I don't want to hear from anybody today. So you were on your own with having to pull information and try to figure out how to service the customers, because, you know, she didn't feel like handling questions. So, you know, in that kind of environment, you know, trying to work hard and trying to do well in spite of that drew criticism from the other team members, because they all felt like victims and they all did as little as possible just so they could get through the workday and then go home. And so, you know, giving them or really succeeding or being really productive meant that someone was going to look and say, why aren't you doing, because this person is doing more, why aren't you doing more? So it was kind of definitely an environment in which you kept your head down and you didn't say anything and you just got through the workday and went home. So in that instance, that politics that you were talking about before was the driving force, I think, for creating enemies in the workplace, and it wasn't a cooperative kind of work environment where we could all succeed together. So I definitely agree with what you said.
Yeah, I think we can all think back to moments in time where those kinds of situations, you know, we see everything sort of in grayscale, and when we decide to do things in color, everyone gets shocked by the fact that you can do it in color. and all of a sudden, you know, it's like, no, we can all be in Technicolor. We really can. And because you've set the standard higher, everyone sort of gets spooked by it, and it happened. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, he asks in the next question for us to describe what values you have that are non-negotiable at work and at home, and whether or not enemies make us stronger and better. Agreed? Disagreed?
This is Miranda, I guess, agreed.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to fall on the sort of Ben Franklin perspective when it comes to values. And, you know, so he had those sort of 13, I think it was 13 values. And, you know, he read them every day, you know, in terms of the standards that he intended on upholding for himself in his life. And I think that that's sort of how I look at the ecosystem for my own value system, which is, does it stand the test of time? Does it stand for everybody on the planet in terms of universal law? You know, I look at those as being values, not necessarily some of the more soft values of a particular culture. So I try to look at it from a much more broad perspective, and I think that helps me stay real in a lot of ways. You know, it doesn't elevate me to this place where it's like, oh, well, I'm in this particular situation, therefore my value is more important than someone else's. If I were any other human on the planet, would this value still stand? And if that's the case, then it's a good value for me. And this lends us right into the next one, which he goes into chapter four, I believe, here, with the integrity choice and this idea of guarding your integrity. I sort of felt like that chapter lent itself really back to the values statement. I'm curious about other people's thoughts in terms of the two chapters. What did you think about the values choice and sort of, you know, who to make enemies with and the idea of integrity here? How do you believe he differentiated them, and what's sort of your take on that chapter? I'm just curious.
This is Margaret. I think on the enemies chapter, the idea of sort of making enemies for the right reason, I'm not sure he quite put it that way, but we've all been around people that just seem to be picking a fight with everybody. I don't think that's a good choice, good way to make enemies. But in terms of choosing that, you know, even beyond the who am I going to disappoint or who's going to be mad at me, my family or my mom, but of who do I want, you know, that I don't want to violate my own values to make someone else happy. I think is more kind of where I was landing on that. And then, yeah, I think the integrity is a foundational thing because, and maybe both, I reviewed everything this morning, so I'm not sure where stuff fell in the various chapters, but the idea of he's hit a couple of times on people that don't do what they say they're going to do, being, you know, both someone that on the kind of his list of people you might want to consider your enemies, like the rebellious and the ones that get drunk at corporate functions, which made me kind of laugh. And, but that idea of the integrity in doing what you say, I think is, and kind of answering the question you'd asked in the previous chapter too, of I think that is really one of my core things. If I say I'm going to do something, and it also, you know, resonates clearly throughout David Allen stuff, through the whole getting things done ecosystem, that if you make a commitment, the choices are kind of you either meet the commitment or you renegotiate it, or you walk around with a lot of energy tied up in that undone thing. And the idea of being around people, and as I've been doing a lot more things with a greater diversity of people over the last few months, meeting a lot of new and different people, of kind of finding myself going, oh, wait, you said you're going to do that and you didn't. I'm not sure that I really want to step closer into ongoing stuff with you. I mean, I'm not cutting you off completely for missing on one thing, but someone that I had met at a different meetup thing, I was like, I'm a little uncertain about this person's follow-through. And so I find that really, in the sort of surrounding yourself with people with similar values, on that one, are they basically trustworthy? I mean, I don't have to agree with the choices that someone is making. I think that goes to your sort of diversity of values and points of view on things. But if someone is not going to do what they said they're going to do and don't seem to care that they, you know, there's no effort to renegotiate or anything like that, that really has resonated for me between these two chapters as something that is becoming a bigger and bigger deal to me. And not in some kind of rigid way, but just in terms of, I'm not going to put myself in a position where I'm going to rely on someone who has repeatedly shown that they're not coming through when they say they're going to do something.
So
they're, you know, big things and little things and whatever. I don't want to parse the whole thing out. But so I think the integrity is really a bedrock for all of this kind of stuff, to summarize.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's sort of lending on your concept of sort of noticing when someone isn't, sort of living up to their word in terms of what they'll do. You know, frequently in networking events, you know, I end up being in lots of business networking events and I enjoy them quite thoroughly. And so people give me their business cards and they tell me how much they want my business most often. And I have to say to them, you know, just generally, you know, I don't just give out my business to someone that I don't know up front. It takes time for me to be able to build that relationship. And what I usually do is underneath all of it, I ask them to do just something small, you know, whether it's follow up with me or answering a question. And I do it on purpose because so many people lack follow through. So if they can't do that out the gate from me in terms of in relationship building, then I have very little use for them in the long term, you know. So I totally get that. And it's just a small little litmus for being able to tell whether or not I'm going to be able to depend on that person. If they can't do something small when I ask them to, you know, in an initial engagement like that when they want my business, then they're not going to be able to be very good to me long term.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
This is Miranda. It seemed to me that in the two chapters, she defined value as your whatever your set of principles are, and integrity was the practice of those. And because he goes into, you know, you can lose integrity, a little bit at a time, kind of like, one little compromise of values and then another little compromise of values. So, you know, it's I think he's making the point that your integrity or your practice of your values should line up with what you actually do believe is important and ethical.
Right, right. So integrity is doing what you say and saying what you mean, as opposed to just the building up of it. I agree with that, and I also consider integrity a value in and of itself. It's a principle in and of itself to live according to your own values. So it's sort of circular in my mind, but I certainly understand the practice and the concept of it. So thank you very much for the clarification. And I wanted to quickly segue us into the last two chapters, just for time purposes. And so we're now jumping into part two, and he talks about in chapter 5 this idea of the do something choice, and he gives these sort of this premise that you want to spend more time on action and less time on thinking about what you want to do, and then he says to study successful people, and then of course to keep learning. And I think those are all good suggestions, and his discussion questions for it are pretty much what prevents us from going from thinking about what we're doing, that is activation energy. What would happen in our organization if every person decided to get serious about reading and committed to reading one book a month? I say, hell yeah. And then number three is name three things you've observed that most successful people within your organization consistently do differently from everyone else. So let's just start off with sort of the activation energy. What keeps people from going from I want to do this to I'm doing it? What do you feel like keeps most people from doing those things?
Well, I would like to quote Mark Horstman here from Manager Tools. He repeatedly says that a decision is both a choice and an action. You know, like the frogs at the beginning of that chapter, if you decide to jump off the lily pad, you haven't done it yet.
Right.
But in that choice plus an action, and it's something I have had to work really hard on internalizing on things where I don't take action, is that I may say I decided, but if I'm not acting, I didn't actually decide. I think it's not reinforced that often people get kind of credit for making the change by just choosing, by just, you know, making the choice. I'm going to, say, eat healthier. Well, I've decided I'm going to do that, but I haven't changed what I buy and I haven't changed how I cook, but I've decided.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of the big things for me, and kind of only word I can think of is inculcating a bias towards action. To practice that, and that's the thing I'm working on myself on a lot of just kind of little projects that I haven't quite finished around the house. It's like, no, I need to just finish the thing, and that requires just some more action. It's not done until it's, you know, done. But just deciding or making the choice to do it without actually doing it, I think, is a huge, huge tripping point, because it feels good. I don't remember who it was, but who talked about, there was a TED Talk, he talked about don't tell people when you're starting something new, because
right,
that actually dissipates some of the energy to do it.
Uh-huh.
And so that people get the same buzz of completion by talking about what they're going to do, that then they don't have the energy to actually go do it sometime.
Right, right.
And I wish I could remember his name, and my internet's down, so I can't search for it, sorry.
I'm searching right now, but I'll tell you if I come up with it. But I certainly agree. I think it's really important that we understand that activation energy, the thing that makes us start action, start doing things, is a separate process from choosing to do something. So I fully agree with you there. You know, I think that it's just a matter of making sure that we are, if you're thinking about GTD or getting things done methodology, then it becomes easier for me, because the choice of doing something is done in planning phase, you know, so that's done in when I'm deciding through the workflow diagram, what is this, you know, what is it, and what does it mean to me, and then outcomes visioning. So I get all of that sort of decision to do something on that macro level, and then on the micro level, I've already made that choice because I've anchored a next action. But sometimes the situation isn't so black and white, you know, and then comes into perspective having to sort of parsing out the decision, the decision moment that you're going to do something from the action that you actually want to do, and deciding on the right action, those kinds of things, you know, especially in the moment is sometimes more difficult than in the pre-planning or the planning phase of things. So, you know, I think there's still a struggle for many people out there in terms of that. Any other thoughts in terms of...
This is Miranda.
Yeah, go for it, Miranda.
Yes. I was just going to say I agree, which is the reason why I decided to start attending the productivity group, because I didn't really know what it was. I knew that, you know, when starting, I'm starting a new business. So in the process of doing it, I had a whole bunch of things to think about and a whole bunch of things to do, and it didn't feel like I had enough time to do them. And a lot of the things that the projects that I needed to do, I was not acting on, is because I did not know what the next actionable step was, or how to figure out what the next actionable step was and then do that thing. So it was a question. It was not necessarily it's more in taking apart something, a project, and then figuring out all of the pieces that go into it, and then how do I do each one of those pieces so that I have a completed project at the end. And I did not know how to tackle that, and so I started reading David Allen's book, and so now things are clearer for me. Just did my first weekly review. I'm really excited about that. So last week, I mean. So I'm really excited about learning those tools. I think that what keeps people on some day aisle is maybe not knowing the next actionable step. And maybe it's fear of the unknown as well, as we talked about in our last meeting.
Mm-hmm. No, I absolutely agree. I mean, being able to get yourself through that process and consistently making it, you know, getting to a state of automaticity, which is a state of something becoming a habit. And that just becomes so powerful when you can habitualize the idea of getting to that next action and being comfortable with that on the whole being 80% of the time you're going to make the best choices through just the habit. And when there are bigger things in life, then you're going to spend a little bit more time, maybe a lot more time, on making that choice. But if you can habitualize all the mundane stuff, I think the stuff that Lee was talking about earlier, that it's like, this is the adult stuff, this is the grown-up stuff I have to do. I may not be passionate about it, but it's got to be done. And so I'm going to tough it out and I'm going to do it. But why spend so much energy on the decisions about what need to be done? You know, if you can habitualize that through the GTD workflow diagram, it becomes so much easier, because you're like, okay, well, I need to get this stuff done, so let's just get it down to the next actions and plow through it, and it becomes so much easier. I honestly can't think about doing it any other way in my life now, because it's just built into me now, you know, and there's so much stress that's not in my life that I know would be if, you know, every little detail had to be thought about because, you know, I didn't already pre-plan it in the, you know, beforehand in my weekly review or in some other planning phase before the week started. You know, it's just all been taken care of, and so I know it's going to be taken care of, and if I don't catch it now, I'm going to catch it in my next weekly review, and it's all going to get down to the next action for the following week. I know that, you know, and I'm comfortable with that, and I know that that means I don't have to stress about it. So we're running up on time. So I want us to quickly go over the sixth chapter, which is persistence choice, and just get anybody's thoughts on the persistence choice itself. So just in summary, he talks about the persistence choice that when you reach roadblocks to your success, that you just don't give up. So, you know, people don't succeed without overcoming obstacles. And, you know, failure itself is a learning tool. And I think when we read the 12-week year, we discussed the difference between failure and failure, you know, and I think we should still continue with that definition here. Failure is stumbling but getting back up and moving on. Failure is choosing not to go on. And I think, you know, in this case, he's really talking about failure, which is the idea of falling down and getting back up and you know, keeping your eye on the prize. And that if you want to win, you have to stay in the game, basically. You know, don't let temporary failure or failure cause you to miss out on permanent success. And so, you know, what are folks' sort of perspectives on persistence and making that persistence choice in their own productive lives?
That's the only way anything gets done. Unless it's a trivially simple task, any project-sized task is going to have hurdles of one scale or another, and you just have to keep pushing through those because they aren't going to go away by themselves this time.
I would absolutely agree. I think this is where The concept of persistent starting comes into play. Dr. Neil Fiore in The Now Habit and several other sociologists as well as psychologists have sort of talked about this concept of if you persistently start, then you're going to get to the finish line because you're continuing along. You know, every time you feel like I'm not doing what I should be doing or want to be doing, then get to the point where you are doing. And if you just keep doggedly going after that goal, that is, I need to make these phone calls, but really I want to play around on Facebook. Well, you know, then you need to refocus and say, I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to make the next phone call. And then, you know, you get distracted or you get back to, on Facebook, you say, okay, I'm recognizing, I'm aware that I'm on Facebook, but I'm going to go back to making those phone calls because those are the things that I need to be doing, or responding to email or writing that next document or doing those things that are more important. And I think that happens a lot in people's world of feeling like, oh, you know, I can't get to the things that are really important in my life. And I always say to them, you know, use persistent starting. You know, keep looking at those goals and saying, what's the next thing that I can do to anchor to my next actions list to get me to starting toward being good? And if you can practice persistent starting, I think you can really make great inroads into success in life just by persistently starting toward that goal or action or whatever it might be. Any final thoughts on persistence?
This is Miranda.
Gotta have it, absolutely. And this is Margaret. It helped to have people that can help remind me of what it was I was going for sometimes. You know, just anywhere from formal accountability arrangements or just, you know, a friend saying, so how's it going on that thing you were talking about? And it's either like, oh, yeah, I'm making good progress on that, or, oh, yeah, life kind of got in the way. I do want to get back to that, and I'm going to. So that having other people in community in various levels that can help, you know, not become responsible for my progress, but that are interested in helping me keep going in the direction I said I wanted to go.
Yeah, it's almost like externalizing persistence. That's great.
Yeah, yeah.
At least in part. Miranda, you had a final thought?
Yeah. Oh, in respect to accountability, and I said, no, I hadn't. I actually do. I do have someone like that. I forgot. So yeah, and I just did that this week. So, yeah, and it does help. It's for those things that, oh, yeah, I did forget about that, but, yeah, I'm getting back to that. And I just, so, yeah, it's a wonderful tool.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you all for this really great conversation. It's been quite interesting and inspiring and all those other things. And so I have a few announcements before we end the call. First and foremost, if you're a podcast listener, the callers you just heard in this episode are readers just like you, and you have more than opportunity or ample choice to read along with us and join the live calls and discuss the productivity books that we're discussing here on the line. So please visit productivitybookgroup.org and find out the details and the schedule for upcoming book discussion calls. If you plan to read ahead or a little more slowly, please visit productivitybookgroup.org and you can see the schedule of our upcoming books, so you can see what we're going to be discussing a month and 2 months and 3 months ahead of time. So our next reading selection is going to be the last half of the book, you know, so chapters 7 through 12 of Monday Morning Choices by David Cottrell. So that discussion will be on October 11th at noon Eastern Time. So hopefully I've got the date right, but it's two Saturdays from now, so October 11th at noon. And finally, all podcast episodes are archived on productivitybookgroup.org under episodes. So if you missed a call and want to review it, feel free to head over there, listen to the back episodes, join us on future live calls. Thank you everyone here who joined me for the live call. You make Productivity Book Group awesome. Stay awesome, and here's to your productive life.